Chapter 3. I was now immeasurably alarmed, for I considered the vision either as an omen of my death, or, worse, as the forerunner of an attack of mania. I threw myself passionately back in my chair, and for some moments buried my face in my hands. When I uncovered my eyes, the apparition was no longer apparent. My host, however, had in some degree resumed the calmness of his demeanor, and questioned me very rigorously in respect to the confirmation of the visionary creature. When I had fully satisfied him on this head, he sighed deeply, as if relieved of some intolerable burden, and went on to talk, with what I thought a cruel calmness, of various points of speculative philosophy, which had heretofore formed subject of discussion between us. I remember his insisting very especially, among other things, upon the idea that the principal source of error in all human investigations lay in the liability of the understanding to underrate or to overvalue the importance of an object through mere misadmeasurement of its propinquity. To estimate properly, for example, he said, the influence to be exercised on mankind at large by the thorough diffusion of democracy, the distance of the epoch at which such diffusion may possibly be accomplished should not fail to form an item in the estimate. Yet can you tell me one writer on the subject of government who has ever thought this particular branch of the subject worthy of discussion at all? He here paused for a moment, stepped to a bookcase, and brought forth one of the ordinary synopses of natural history, requesting me then to exchange seats with him, that he might the better distinguish the fine print of the volume. He took my armchair at the window, and, opening the book, resumed his discourse very much in the same tone as before. But for your exceeding minuteness, he said, in describing the monster, I might never have had it in my power to demonstrate to you what it was. In the first place, let me read to you a schoolboy account of the genus Sphinx, of the family Crepuscularia, of the order Lepidoptera, of the class of insects. The account runs thus. Four membranous wings covered with little colored scales of metallic appearance, mouth forming a rolled proboscis, produced by an elongation of the jaws, upon the sides of which are found the rudiments of mandibles and downy palpi, the inferior wings retained to the superior by a stiff hair, antennae in the form of an elongated club, prismatic, abdomen pointed. The death's-headed sphinx has occasioned much terror among the vulgar, at times, by the melancholy kind of cry which it utters, and the insignia of death which it wears upon its corslet. Apostrophe, he here closed the book, and leaned forward in the chair, placing himself accurately in the position which I had occupied at the moment of beholding the monster. Ah, here it is, he presently exclaimed, he is reascending the face of the hill, and a very remarkable looking creature I admit it to be. Still, it is by no means so large, or so distant as you imagined it, for the fact is that, as it wriggles its way up this thread, which some spider has wrought along the window sash, I find it to be about the 16th of an inch in its extreme length, and also about the 16th of an inch distant from the pupil of my eye. Tilde 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 end of text tilde 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 equals 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 Hop Frog. I never knew anyone so keenly alive to a joke as the king was. He seemed to live only for joking. To tell a good story of the joke kind, and to tell it well, was the surest road to his favor. Thus it happened that his seven ministers were all noted for their accomplishments as jokers. They all took after the king too, in being large, corpulent, oily men, as well as inimitable jokers. Whether people grow fat by joking, or whether there is something in fat itself which predisposes to a joke, I have never been quite able to determine. But certain it is that a lean joker is a rara avis in terris. About the refinements, or, as he called them, the ghost of wit, the king troubled himself very little. He had an especial admiration for breadth in a jest, and would often put up with length, for the sake of it. Over niceties wearied him. He would have preferred Rabelais Gargantua to the Zadig of Voltaire. and, upon the whole, practical jokes suited his taste far better than verbal ones. At the date of my narrative, professing jesters had not altogether gone out of fashion at court. Several of the great continental powers still retained their fools, apostrophe who wore motley, with caps and bells, and who were expected to be always ready with sharp witticisms, at a moment's notice, in consideration of the crumbs that fell from the royal table. Our king, as a matter of course, retained his fool. Apostrophe, apostrophe, the fact is, he required something in the way of folly, if only to counterbalance the heavy wisdom of the seven wise men who were his ministers, not to mention himself. His fool, or professional jester, was not only a fool, however. His value was trebled in the eyes of the king, by the fact of his being also a dwarf and a cripple. Dwarfs were as common at court, in those days, as fools. And many monarchs would have found it difficult to get through their days. Days are rather longer at court than elsewhere, without both a jester to laugh with, and a dwarf to laugh at. But, as I have already observed, your jesters, in 99 cases out of 100, are fat, round, and unwieldy, so that it was no small source of self-gratulation with our king that, in Hop Frog, this was the fool's name, he possessed a triplicate treasure in one person. I believe the name Hop Frog was not that given to the dwarf by his sponsors at baptism, but it was conferred upon him, by general consent of the several ministers, on account of his inability to walk as other men do. In fact, Hop Frog could only get along by a sort of interjectional gait, something between a leap and a wriggle, a movement that afforded illimitable amusement, and of course consolation, to the king, for notwithstanding the protuberance of his stomach, and a constitutional swelling of the head, the king, by his whole court, was accounted a capital figure. But although Hop Frog, through the distortion of his legs, could move only with great pain and difficulty along a road or floor, the prodigious muscular power which nature seemed to have bestowed upon his arms, by way of compensation for deficiency in the lower limbs, enabled him to perform many feats of wonderful dexterity, where trees or oaks were in question, or anything else to climb. At such exercises he certainly much more resembled a squirrel, or a small monkey, than a frog. I am not able to say, with precision, from what country Hop Frog originally came. It was from some barbarous region, however, that no person ever heard of, a vast distance from the court of our king. Hop Frog, and a young girl very little less dwarfish than himself, although of exquisite proportions, and a marvelous dancer, had been forcibly carried off from their respective homes in adjoining provinces, and sent as presents to the king, by one of his ever-victorious generals. Under these circumstances, it is not to be wondered at, that a close intimacy arose between the two little captives. Indeed, they soon became sworn friends. Hop Frog, who, although he made a great deal of sport, was by no means popular, had it not in his power to render Trippetta many services. But she, on account of her grace and exquisite beauty, although a dwarf, was universally admired and petted. So she possessed much influence, and never failed to use it, whenever she could, for the benefit of Hop Frog. On some grand state occasion, I forgot what the king determined to have a masquerade, and whenever a masquerade or anything of that kind occurred at our court, then the talents, both of Hop Frog and Trippetta, were sure to be called into play. Hop Frog, in especial, was so inventive in the way of getting up pageants, suggesting novel characters, and arranging costumes for masked balls, that nothing could be done, it seems, without his assistance. The night appointed for the fete had arrived. A gorgeous hall had been fitted up, under Trippetta's eye, with every kind of device which could possibly give eclat to a masquerade. The whole court was in a fever of expectation. As for costumes and characters, it might well be supposed that everybody had come to a decision on such points. Many had made up their minds as to what roles they should assume a week or even a month in advance. And, in fact, there was not a particle of indecision anywhere except in the case of the king and his seven ministers. Why they hesitated I never could tell, unless they did it by way of a joke. More probably, they found it difficult, on account of being so fat, to make up their minds. At all events, time flew, and, as a last resort they sent for Trippetta and Hop Frog. When the two little friends obeyed the summons of the king they found him sitting at his wine with the seven members of his cabinet council, but the monarch appeared to be in a very ill humor. He knew that Hop Frog was not fond of wine, for it excited the poor cripple almost to madness, and madness is no comfortable feeling. But the king loved his practical jokes, and took pleasure in forcing Hop Frog to drink, and, as the king called it, to be merry. Come here, Hop Frog, said he, as the jester and his friend entered the room. Swallow this bumper to the health of your absent friends. Here Hop Frog sighed, and then let us have the benefit of your invention. We want characters, man something novel out of the way. We are wearied with this everlasting sameness. Come, drink. The wine will brighten your wits. Hop Frog endeavored, as usual, to get up a jest in reply to these advances from the king, but the effort was too much. It happened to be the poor dwarf's birthday, and the command to drink to his absent friends forced the tears to his eyes. Many large bitter drops fell into the goblet as he took it, humbly, from the hand of the tyrant. Ah, ha, ha, roared the latter, as the dwarf reluctantly drained the beaker. See what a glass of good wine can do. Why, your eyes are shining already. Poor fellow, his large eyes gleamed, rather than shone, for the effect of wine on his excitable brain was not more powerful than instantaneous. He placed the goblet nervously on the table, and looked round upon the company with a half-insane stare. They all seemed highly amused at the success of the king's joke. And now to business, said the prime minister, a very fat man. Yes, said the king, come lend us your assistance. Characters, my fine fellow, we stand in need of characters all of us, ha, ha, ha. And as this was seriously meant for a joke, his laugh was chorused by the seven. Hop Frog also laughed, although feebly and somewhat vacantly. Come, come, said the king, impatiently, have you nothing to suggest? I am endeavoring to think of something novel, replied the dwarf, abstractedly, for he was quite bewildered by the wine. Endeavoring, cried the tyrant, fiercely. What do you mean by that? Ah, I perceive. You are sulky, and want more wine. Here, drink this. And he poured out another goblet full, and offered it to the cripple, who merely gazed at it, gasping for breath. Drink, I say, shouted the monster, or by the fiends, the dwarf hesitated. The king grew purple with rage. The courtiers smirked. Trippetta, pale as a corpse, advanced to the monarch's seat, and, falling on her knees before him, implored him to spare her friend. The tyrant regarded her, for some moments, in evident wonder at her audacity. He seemed quite at a loss what to do, or say how most becomingly to express his indignation. At last, without uttering a syllable, he pushed her violently from him, and threw the contents of the brimming goblet in her face. The poor girl got up the best she could, and, not daring even to sigh, resumed her position at the foot of the table. There was a dead silence for about half a minute, during which the falling of a leaf, or of a feather, might have been heard. It was interrupted by a low, but harsh and protracted grating sound which seemed to come at once from every corner of the room. What are you making that noise for? Demanded the king, turning furiously to the dwarf. The latter seemed to have recovered, in great measure, from his intoxication, and looking fixedly but quietly into the tyrant's face, merely ejaculated. How could it have been me? The sound appeared to come from without, observed one of the courtiers. I fancy it was the parrot at the window, whetting his bill upon his cage wires. True, replied the monarch, as if much relieved by the suggestion. But, on the honor of a knight, I could have sworn that it was the gritting of this vagabond's teeth. Hereupon the dwarf laughed. The king was too confirmed a joker to object to anyone's laughing, and displayed a set of large, powerful, and very repulsive teeth. Moreover, he avowed his perfect willingness to swallow as much wine as desired. The monarch was pacified, and having drained another bumper with no very perceptible ill effect, Hop Frog entered at once, and with spirit, into the plans for the masquerade. I cannot tell what was the association of idea, observed he, very tranquilly, and as if he had never tasted wine in his life, but just after your majesty had struck the girl, and thrown the wine in her face just after your majesty had done this, and while the parrot was making that odd noise outside the window, there came into my mind a capital diversion one of my own country frolics often enacted among us, at our masquerades. But here it will be new altogether. Unfortunately, however, it requires a company of 8 persons and here we are, cried the king, laughing at his acute discovery of the coincidence. 8 to a fraction I and my 7 ministers. Come, what is the diversion? We call it, replied the cripple, the 8 chained orangutans, and it really is excellent sport if well enacted. We will enact it, remarked the king, drawing himself up, and lowering his eyelids. The beauty of the game, continued Hop Frog, lies in the frighted occasions among the women. Capital, roared in chorus the monarch and his ministry. I will equip you as orangutans, proceeded the dwarf. Leave all that to me. The resemblance shall be so striking, that the company of masqueraders will take you for real beasts and of course, they will be as much terrified as astonished. Oh, this is exquisite! Exclaimed the king. Hop Frog! I will make a man of you. The chains are for the purpose of increasing the confusion by their jangling. You are supposed to have escaped, en masse, from your keepers. Your majesty cannot conceive the effect produced, at a masquerade, by 8 chained orangutans, imagined to be real ones by most of the company, and rushing in with savage cries, among the crowd of delicately and gorgeously habited men and women. The contrast is inimitable. It must be, said the king. And the council arose hurriedly as it was growing late, to put in execution the scheme of Hop Frog. His mode of equipping the party as orangutans was very simple, but effective enough for his purposes. The animals in question had, at the epoch of my story, very rarely been seen in any part of the civilized world, and as the imitations made by the dwarf were sufficiently beast-like and more than sufficiently hideous, their truthfulness to nature was thus thought to be secured. The king and his ministers were first encased in tight-fitting stock in it. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.